For more than a decade now, the ecologist Nalini Nadkarni has been interested in disturbances. Her specialty is trees, so she's been exploring the effects of disturbances like climate change, like fire, on forests. But a few years ago, her interest in the subject made a dramatic turn from the academic to the very, very personal. Nalini does canopy research, so she has to go up, up into the canopy to do this work. And so one morning in the summer of 2015, that was the plan.
It was a perfect day for climbing trees. The sky was blue, it was crisp. I had three graduate students with me. This was the first time that they were going to climb, and I was excited to be training them how to climb to do their own canopy research in the future. About 9 a.m, we parked our cars near this sort of big open area where we actually saw a bunch of elk, a wonderful herd of elk there. You know, we were all set for just a fabulous day of field work. When I'm climbing with a group, I really like to go up first. I feel still like I'm going into this new world, this new place. What will I see up there? Will there be a new species of moss? Some new interaction that I might discover when I'm in this unknown frontier place? I really love those moments of just being in the canopy, looking around, you know, like adjusting to the fact that I'm not on the flat ground anymore. I'm in this three-dimensional volume of green, strong branches going in all directions. I really enjoy that change of perspective and taking a few moments to adjust to that. So I was sitting on this branch, and you know, normally you feel this tension on the rope because it's tied tightly and it's tied on the bottom and it goes up and over a branch and attaches to your harness. And as I leaned over, I suddenly felt that tension, that sort of comforting tension that I have felt for the last 40 years, just give way. I fell. The rope had failed. That connection had been broken, snapped. I wasn't attached to anything. That was it. It was over. I remember looking up at the crown of that tree and seeing it, not from the top of the tree, but from the bottom, from the floor looking up and thinking, wait, what happened? And I remember the smells of the mosses and the soil. And I thought, wait, why am I smelling soil? And I remember looking around me at these stumps that were just standing there arrayed around me, and they were like tombstones. Am I in a cemetery? Where am I?
Okay.
And just very gradually, I began hearing the voices of my students. I began kind of looking around and realizing that I was, in fact, lying on my back underneath the tree that I had just been suspended in. The first realization of something has happened. This is a disturbance, and I'm just starting it. You see movies or films of people falling from buildings and the violence of that action. And I realized that I myself had participated in that kind of violent reaction. It sort of stuns me. And it's sort of the violence that I've seen when I've seen trees themselves being cut down. Like, this shouldn't be happening. This shouldn't be moving from vertical to horizontal. This is supposed to be standing. And I can only suppose that that's exactly what my students had witnessed when they saw the violence of my fall. Even though it was mid-morning, I felt like the sun had gone out, and I felt like I was going to go out. I had many injuries, including 5 exploded vertebrae in my back and a cervical vertebrae that was cut and 9 broken ribs and 3 pelvis breaks and a broken fibula and traumatic brain injury. So there was a lot that was broken, and it was all very painful. And I was convinced I was going to die. I was trying to absorb the smells and the sounds and the flavors of where I was, because I thought, this is going to be my last in-breath. You know, I wanted my husband there. I wanted my kids there. Instead, it was just the sense of darkness, inexplicable darkness, even though the sun was shining bright. And I remember thinking, things will never be the same again. Even if I stay alive right now, there's going to be a before this moment and an after this moment. That was a moment of emotion, a moment of realization, a moment where that sense of before a disturbance and after disturbance settled into my bones, my flesh, and my mind and my spirit. And that I had never felt before.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So that experience intensified Nalini's interest in disturbance, because now she had something personal to connect it to. And what she's learned, both from trees and from the fall, is that life is dynamic. That is the natural order of things, and disturbance is just part of that. Yes, it can be gut-wrenching, but it can also make things, make us, better. And this might be the toughest part, Nalini has learned that after a disturbance, you can never go back to your original state. You have to find another state of mind. Nalini calls this, in fact, a third state. Since we're all in this period of disturbance right now, we've asked Nalini Nadkarni to join us and to talk about what she's learned about disturbance. She's joining us now. Nalini Nadkarni is an ecologist, professor of biology at the University of Utah. And welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug.
I guess I wanted to begin. When did this revelation come to you that you were going to be changed by all of this, that you may not get back to that original place? Like, what point in the process of recovery after the fall did that start to come to you?
Well, I have to say, especially after hearing that sequence, which really was violent and was profound, is that that profound insight came to me almost immediately, that I immediately knew that I would not be the same. I didn't have any idea whether I would live, whether I would walk, whether I would play, whether I would work, whether I would climb trees again. But I knew that life was going to be different. And I think what progressed over my physical recovery, which took about a year, I would say, is that I got more information about what I would be able to do physically. It also grew on me how I might change emotionally, psychologically, and socially, and spiritually, for that matter. But it's still a continuing process. I'm still not sure who I am at this point as a result of that disturbance. But I knew from the very beginning, and continue to know, that change has taken place. I'm not going back to the Nalini that fell from that tree.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go back before the fall. And okay. I wanted to ask you about What got you interested in disturbances in the first place? I mean, for like 10 years or maybe more than that, you've been interested in learning about the effects of disturbances on rainforests, on trees, on forests. Why the interest in that?
Well, I think if you're an ecologist is someone who understands or tries to understand the interaction of plants and animals and the environment, you're always aware of disturbances. You know, you can't walk through even a primary rainforest, a redwood forest, or a tropical rainforest that has been untouched apparently by human interactions, for example, for centuries. You're always aware that disturbance is going on. You know, you see a tree fall, you see an animal flying from one tree to another with seeds in its beak, and you know that the environment and the biota are always changing. But I guess it was in the you know, when I started out my career as a forest ecologist studying the forest canopy of rainforests, I studied almost entirely in primary pristine rainforests in Costa Rica and Washington State. I wanted to understand, as many ecologists do, how does a system work when it's not disturbed? And you would sort of never choose a study site that had any indication of disturbance at all. But of course, in the 1990s, biologists and the general public became aware of the growing amount of disturbances that were being caused by human activities, of deforestation, of conversion of primary forests to agriculture, of invasive species, of climate change. And so it seemed natural as an ecologist seeking to understand how these beautiful, complex, important systems work would be to understand the effects of both natural and human disturbances on trees and forests. And so that's when I began thinking about in what ways I might come to understand particular disturbances on these trees and forests, and in particular, the canopy organisms that I was so bent on understanding.
So I was interested in this. One of the things that you keyed on is these single trees that had been left standing after farmers clear a forest to make a pasture. And they're called relict trees. Talk a little bit about this part of it, because it seems like this gets us to the idea of isolation, and that seems important in understanding all of this.
Right. Well, there was actually a moment I remember when I kind of shifted my study plan to understand these relic trees. And I was sitting in the top of a large strangler fig in the middle of the Monteverde Cloud Forest Reserve, where I do most of my research. And I was sitting there just carrying out my measurements, and I heard the sound of a chainsaw just outside the borders of the reserve. And it was really at that moment that I thought, whoa, you know, these pastures are being created just outside these protected areas. And I wonder what I might learn about trees that are left in those pastures that could contribute to maintaining biodiversity or ecosystem function, just as trees in the primary forest sustain biodiversity and maintain ecosystem function. And it's true, in many pastures in many tropical regions, farmers will leave trees, individual trees or small clumps of trees, standing in pastures. They might want them for shade, for the fruit they provide, for the medicinal plants that they provide. They might provide aesthetics. You know, sometimes the farmer will say, well, it's just a beautiful tree and I decided to leave it there. But my question was whether or not those relic trees, those trees that had been brought up in the primary forest but are now isolated by kind of you might think of it as a sea of pasture around those trees, how are they functioning? Are they able to maintain the plants and animals that existed in them before this clearing happened? Or are they sort of what we might call the living dead? That is, trees that, you know, once they die, they're not really functioning. Or they, even when they're living and standing there, they might not be able to attract the birds that pollinate them or the mammals that disperse their fruits. So in essence, they might as well not be there. So I was trying to understand how they function in these altered landscapes and whether they are vectors of preservation of diversity and ecosystem function, or whether they simply, their isolation does not allow them to function in that way.
Okay, so I don't want to overdo this, so push back on me if I go too far. But I'm
okay.
But clearly, we're all thinking about isolation right now. We're all in isolation. Is there a connection between those of us who are feeling lonely or disconnected right now because we can't go out or shouldn't go out, and a tree in a pasture, a lonely tree?
I think, Doug, that's a really insightful question. I think there's no doubt that isolation is one of the consequences of disturbance, and which can have consequences not only in our physical well-being, but also on our emotional and psychological well-being. And it was actually when I was in the hospital, I had just come out of the intensive care unit, and I was lying at night in a hospital bed by myself. I was feeling so alone. I was feeling so frightened because I had no idea if I would walk again, if I would work again, if I would function in the same way I had before, that I began thinking about and visualizing those very trees that I had been studying the month before, those tall strangler figs that were isolated like sentinels in the middle of these large pastures, far away from their brothers and sisters in the primary forest. And I didn't know whether birds would fly out to them or little, you know, mammals would get out to them to disperse their seeds. That's what I wanted to know. But I felt very much like one of those lonely sentinel trees when I was there isolated in the hospital. And I can only imagine that people who are experiencing this virus, experiencing the isolation, the social distancing, even that we're all feeling, can really identify with the challenges that those very trees face when they become isolated.
Is that why you reached out to me? Why you sent me an email? Is you saw an opportunity to really put into practice this idea of disturbance in a really big way?
That is exactly why I sent you that email, Doug, because I know that everybody listens to Radio West. And I know also that you and I have had conversations about disturbance and recovery from the standpoint of trees and forests and my fall. And then since then, since we made that little film called Fallen Tree a few years ago, you know, a year after I fell, I have been continuing to think about the consequences of disturbance and recovery, the spectrum of ways that we might respond to disturbance and recovery. And thanks to the input of a number of my colleagues, where we set up a colloquium to talk about disturbance and recovery in a variety of disciplines, I think that we've come up with a number of insights that could be helpful to people and systems, actually, who are experiencing the consequences of disturbance at this time. Not everything that we came up with in terms of studying trees and traffic and other systems has relevance to humans and our current situation. But I think there's a good chance that what we have come up with through an intellectual approach to understanding disturbance and recovery, of being open to the wide spectrum of consequences, not just bad, but some good, some positive. Yeah. And this, as you said, the inevitable change in our state of being, both physical as well as emotional, I think might be of use as all of us come to terms with having been stopped, having to have the opportunity to consider what is meaningful in our lives, what do we have the capacity to do in this moment, and perhaps most importantly, if we can learn from past disturbances of ourselves and others, how might we be better prepared to face the inevitable disturbances that will arise in the future.
Okay, we're going to get into what you've learned with this collection of academics and others that you created this colloquium for. We're going to get to that here in a second. Before we do that, I want to ask you something about what you describe as the ubiquity of disturbance. And you say we expect stasis. We count on continuity. And we deny disturbance. Why is that? Why do we deny this idea of disturbance? Is that some sort of evolutionary trait sort of baked into us? Why is that so, I guess?
Boy, that's a great question. I don't know whether it's evolutionary baked into us, but it's certainly what makes our systems move forward. I mean, we're homeostatic organisms. That is, we keep the same temperature. 98.6 is what how our organs and our cell processes best function. When we have a stable economy, you know, we can count on earning a living. We can count on spending money on what we wish to spend. When I walk through a forest and I see the trees standing just as they have for centuries. I know that they're photosynthesizing, they're capturing sunlight energy, they're creating habitat for other animals. And so I think there's a certain appeal to stability. But I think that, and I think that we usually see this idea of disturbance as a disruption, yeah. as a break, as something negative. I mean, even if you look up the definition of disturbance in the dictionary, it almost always has a negative context. And so I think the consequence of that, of seeing disturbance as negative, has made it very difficult for us to presume that, in fact, there might be positive things that come out of that. And one of the things that came up in the colloquium, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, is the potential positive aspects that do come out of disturbance. But overall, even the language that we use with forest fires, for example, catastrophic, devastating, all of those words that are almost always attached to disturbance are negative. And I know when I first fell and was in the hospital and my friends and family would come, they'd say, oh, tragic event, you know, catastrophic destruction. And, you know, it didn't make me feel any better in the hospital about being characterized as being a tragic event.
Right.
But really, it was, it took me a while to understand that this, you know, this box of darkness, as Mary Oliver has called the disturbance, might have some light that could come out of that. So I think that's something that we can keep talking about, which is this spectrum of consequences that we as humans perceive disturbance to be.
Okay, so let's do that after a break. Nalini Nadkarni is with us. She's an ecologist, professor of biology at the University of Utah. She mentioned that film, a Radio West film that we did a few years ago about that fall from a tree. You can find it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
As a kid, you don't really want to stick out. But for Pete Philbrook, his faith left him no other option. He was different.
There's always an explanation that you have to provide to these other kids. What'd you get for Christmas?
Well, this week on Preach, what it's like to grow up in a strict Jehovah's Witness household, going door to door in your hometown as a teenager, and yes, not celebrating holidays. That's Preach. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the Utah ecologist Nalini Nadkarni is with us to talk about the lessons she learned when she fell from a tree a few years ago. She almost died. And disturbance, she says, can bring creativity and joy. Professor Nadkarni is with us. And I wanted to ask you about this colloquium. So let's talk about the people you gathered together and what you were trying to learn. Just what the question was that you were trying to get at here.
Sure. So as I mentioned, I'm really interested in the ecological role that these standing relic trees that are isolated in pastures, how they function in ecological systems and landscapes. And I actually wrote a proposal to the National Science Foundation to see if I could carry out, they'd give me support to carry out research on this. And they responded by saying, well, the reviewers thought this was a good idea, but you know, there's really no theory. There's no ecological theory about relic structures and how they affect regeneration and recovery. So I'm sorry, we can't fund you because your results would just pertain to where you're working. And I was, of course, disappointed. And I thought, well, nope, there is no theory in ecological systems about relic structures. But maybe in other fields, other academic fields besides forest ecology that are concerned with disturbance and recovery, maybe they have some theory that I could borrow and relate to my relic trees and pastures. And so I work at the University of Utah, which is a magnificent institution with, you know, 33,000 students and an incredible set of resources in the faculty that it has in terms of the research that they do. And happily, on our website, we have a function called Find a Researcher. So you can just type in keywords and out come a list of faculty who do research on that topic. So I typed in disturbance recovery, and lo and behold, this group of faculty names came out, and I sent them an email and I asked them, would you be interested in discussing with me how your field handles or has theory or approaches or practices or ways of understanding the processes of disturbance and recovery with special emphasis on relic structures. And so unbelievably, they all responded with a positive, yes, we'd love to do this. So they were from the fields of refugee studies, which studies the disturbance, of course, of populations that are forced to migrate from one country to another. So that's the disturbance there. The field of human development, of course, humans experience breaks in relationships. And so human development is a very good field for that. Urban planning, we have hurricanes going across urban areas and causing all kinds of disturbance. Traffic engineering, we are all very familiar with traffic jams. And so how do traffic engineers deal with traffic jams and come to understand how to mitigate those disturbances? We had a member from the who studies burn trauma, another disturbance. From the neurosciences, we have brain injuries or strokes, which is a disturbance to neurons in our brains. Economics is another system that people there study, you know, depressions and disturbances to the economy. And then finally, modern dance. I was really glad to welcome a member of the arts who could talk about changes, disturbances in the creative process.
You were all over the map. I mean,
yes.
Right? I mean, that was the idea, I suppose.
That was the idea. The idea was to be so open to the idea that other disciplines might have insights into something that I was interested in, and that what I was interested in, that is these trees, if we could sort of develop, not theory, but if we could look at processes of discovery, of disturbance and recovery, we might find some elements in common. We might be able to exchange theory or approaches of understanding. We might join our different ways of knowing systems that would be helpful to each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, I couldn't promise them that we'd come out with a paper or a proposal or a project that would bring us, you know, fame in our own departments. But what we thought we might do is to excite each other intellectually, to stimulate our own thinking, and to share what each of our fields has produced in this area that would be useful to others.
I actually want to get at least two members of that colloquium involved in the conversation. We couldn't invite everybody, but let me welcome Dr. Scott Ward. He's a professor and the chair of the physical therapy and athletic training at the University of Utah. He studies burn injuries and rehabilitation. And Dr. Ward, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And Dr. Russell Isabella is with us, an associate professor of family and consumer studies at the University of Utah, specializes in infant and child development. And Dr. Isabella, welcome to you.
Yeah, thank you. Happy to be here.
All right, Dr. Ward and Dr. Isabella, just give me your first sense of when Nalini approached you about all of this. What did you think about it, and how did this start to play out as you got together and had these conversations?
Well, we began by meeting, at least I began by meeting Nalini in her office for private conversation. I think she was just investigating whether or not I had anything to contribute to the colloquium. And in my field of burn care, I think I had a great deal to contribute because I look at things from a biologic healing perspective. And I got very excited when she started to explain this idea of disturbance and recovery and felt that I could learn from some of my other colleagues looking at their systems and how they might either recover or not recover very well from disturbance. So that's how I began, and then I just have to tell you the colloquium itself was an incredible academic experience.
Hmm. Dr. Isabella, what about you?
Same. Began with a meeting with Nalini individually and sort of drawn into her passion about the topic and had some thoughts immediately about how it related to my field and to my work. But it's also true that as the colloquium went on, I gained a deeper sense for how this all applied to the work that I do and the kinds of things that I've been studying my entire career.
Say more about that, if you would, Dr. Isabella. One of the things you've mentioned is that, and this was interesting, I hadn't really thought of it this way, I guess child development itself is just a series of disturbances and recoveries. That's how we grow and develop and learn, I guess.
Well, actually, development throughout the entire life course
is
really an ongoing series of disturbances and recoveries. And I think this might be related to the question you asked earlier about why humans are sort of averse to the disorganization that characterizes disturbance. And I think it's because we are, and perhaps this is, well, it is an evolutionary result, that we're driven to remove ourselves from the chaos and disorganization of disturbance to a more stable place, which is the recovery. So that's what development is all about. So you can think of the two-year-old who has mastered language and mastered mobility and has developed relationships, has begun to make sense of the world, sitting on top of the world, stability, at, you know, well-defined. And then there's this hint at the fact that you will at some point not be wearing those diapers, you'll be using the toilet. And now that you have language, we'd prefer that you use that language rather than cry. And when we ask you not to touch something, we expect you to listen to us. And so these challenges sort of surpass the capacities entry into that next stage, and that leads to the disturbance. And development is a motivation to develop new skills and meet those challenges so that you can get back to that stability, that recovery.
Nalini Nadkarni, tell me how this translates into, I guess, sort of one of the ideas that you were talking about. Does this get us to the idea of creating functional change, how we have to be able to change habits and actions and attitudes? How does this part fit, I guess?
Absolutely. So one thing that we did with a colloquium after we spent the first semester with each of us presenting his or her sort of summary of disturbance and recovery and how we study it in our own fields, we spent the second semester pulling out what we called emerging themes that pertain to two or more of the topics or the disciplines that were represented. And one of the emerging themes was the importance of or the possibility of switching roles that happens as a consequence of disturbance. So this idea of we have to actually people or entities in our system, they have to switch their roles. And what one of the things I learned from Rossio Sabella about human development is when a baby loses a parent, for example, and through death or divorce, if a relative steps in and takes on that function of being a mother or father, that can really mitigate the negative consequences that the break from a parent can produce if that attachment or that replacement, that shift in roles hadn't taken place. So I think that's an example of how, you know, Russ was able to give us a concrete example in human development. But I saw that with my own fall. For example, my role started changing as I went from being in my disturbed state to my recovery state. Before I fell, you know, I took care of my two kids. So they were, you know, I'm the mom, I take care of my kids. But after the fall, immediately after the fall, for example, my kids came to my bedside, and my daughter Erica, who's now 27, was really amazing in her ability to help me through those early stages. At one point she said, "Hey mom, sounds like you're frustrated. What we need to go is go out and scream at the, just let's go outside and scream." And so we did. And it was an enormous relief. And that she said, "Now let's whisper our gratitude for what we still have." And so we did that. And I thought that was an incredibly wise thing to present to me at that stage. And it was not some elder that told me that. It was my own daughter. And so here was this shift of roles that had taken place.
So it sounds like, Dr. Sabella, that one of the things that you all learned is that we can replace the thing that's missing, or we can find a way to go forward without the thing that we had, but we're going to need this web of social relationships. Is that one of the things that you talked about?
Yes, and to the extent that those social relationships are part of the relict structures, because that was the tie-in. So with the child who loses a parent, say they lose their mother, but if their father remains in their life and they have a good relationship with their father, that certainly can help to mitigate the effect of that absolutely tragic loss of the mother. So in Nalini's terms, the father would be the relict structure. And as you're talking about it, these social connections would be the things that continue to exist around us in the face of this disturbance that we're facing.
Okay, so let's talk about, Dr. Ward, I want to bring you into this part of the conversation, because how does this work with a biological function, like the physiology part? How does that play a role in this part of the conversation?
Well, what I can do is give you an idea of how it plays a role in the world I'm most familiar with, and that is the world of skin. But then I think it clearly plays a role in what's happening today. So one of the things that happens when skin is injured, and if we use a burn injury as one of those examples, it really depends on the amount of devastation of the injury, or how much or how deeply the skin is burned, and how many relic structures in the skin remain. And the intriguing thing about skin is the more relic structures that still exist in the skin, the more likely it is to regenerate and become either return to normal or become more normal than you might hope. If few relic structures are present, what you end up with is a scar tissue, and the reason for the scar and the reason that the body replaces normal skin with this collagen matrix is to get back to the skin's most basic function, and that is to protect the organism from infection. And so if there's relic structure present, that's a helpful thing. And I think in this world now of pandemic, the relic structure we hope to find is a healthy enough immune system to begin to fight this and other viruses in a way to be able to develop immunity against them. And if we don't have enough relic structure, or we don't have a strong enough immune system, we're clearly more vulnerable to the invasion of this virus and other infective organisms and pathogens. And so I think that if you look at this biologically, every system works in the same way. There's a disturbance to the system. There's an inflammatory response. That inflammatory response is meant to help take care of the sequelae of that disturbance and try to reset the tissue to a point where it can hopefully regenerate. If it can't, then it's replaced by less functional tissue, but tissue that somehow at least tries to preserve the structure of the system.
Nalini Nadkarni, you say we have to get to a third state. What is that?
I think, boy, that third state is really interesting. And one of the big revelations of our colloquium was that we understood that very often when you have a disturbance, you have an original state. You start with an original state. That was me climbing a tree, carrying out field work. Then you have a disturbed state, which was me lying on the forest floor. And the expectation was that I would get better. The best case scenario was I would get better, return to work, climb trees again, and so forth. And so my doctors were always saying, and my friends and family were saying, Nalini, are you back to yourself yet? Are you back to yourself yet? And they would love it if I could say, yes, I'm back to myself. I'm running half marathons and I'm climbing trees and I'm back to work. But, you know, what we began realizing as we looked at examples of, quote, recovered systems in our following disturbances is that it was almost never that a system that had been disturbed would return exactly to its former state. Our urban planner Sarah Hinners, for example, said, well, New Orleans was hit by a hurricane and it's recovered in that it's functioning, but it's not the same New Orleans. And I found that happened to me too. I remember being very afraid that I wouldn't recover to my former Nalini state of being energetic and professional and carrying out lots of projects. And I remember a conversation I had with a former counselor of mine, Jean Cavendish. And I said, Jean, I'm worried I'm not going to be back to myself. And she said, well, Nalini, you've been stopped. And so you're going to go through a period of boredom and patience. And that might lead you to a new place of creativity and spirituality. And I thought, oh, now there's a promise. I like that. And so I think that's, you know, now 5 years later, I feel that I'm paying attention to that. I'm thinking about not just getting back to the old Nalini, but thinking about, well, what has meaning to my life now? Is it another grant proposal, another published paper, you know, another project with lots of colleagues? And I'm finding that I still enjoy that, but I'm looking for other things that are, in fact, a more spiritual Nalini. I'm looking for a more creative Nalini. I'm looking to clear space for things that relate to creativity and spirituality, and especially community that I didn't seek before my disturbance, because what has become meaningful from the insights of that disturbance is the importance of connection, which is really spirituality, the importance of community, which I think is also spirituality, and so is creativity. So I've learned how to turn wooden bowls. I go down to the workshop at the Utah Arts Alliance. My husband Jack and I have started Monday home evenings. And on Sundays, we create a huge dinner. We cook our heads off on Sunday, and then we invite, 20 or 25 people over for dinner every Monday night. And it's about, the joy of that connection with people that I hadn't made time for before because I was so busy with that next proposal and that next paper. And so, my third state is a different state. It might look pretty similar to what I was doing before, but inside I know that I've shifted and I'm now making room for other changes that I'm not even quite sure what they will be.
Yeah.
But that's what I mean by a third state.
Yeah.
Sometimes hard to describe, but it is really thanks to being stopped, thanks to that faulty rope, thanks to the pain and worry and concern and fear that I experienced in the last 5 years that have led me to this, I think, better place of joy and spirituality and keeping some of the other things, the old relic things that I still love and enjoy and want to keep going. They still have meaning, but it's just kind of shifted me. And I'm curious to see what those shifts might be in our collective society. Because we have all been stopped, and it will be interesting to see what that third state is.
We need to head into a break, but I want to hear from Dr. Ward and Dr. Isabella finally. Take off the academic part for a moment, gentlemen, and just talk a little bit about what you learned from that colloquium or how you're thinking about disturbance in maybe a more emotional way, if you don't mind, as you're thinking about us all being isolated right now in the midst of a pandemic. Dr. Ward, you first.
Thanks, Doug. I think this is the colloquium was an intriguing stop in my life just to think about the impact of disturbance from perspectives of many people who've now become friends through that endeavor. And it's hard for me to take off my biologic hat, but when I think about it emotionally, I also think about it scientifically, and I have to look forward to the recovery of the human species will develop immunities against this, but there will be inevitable new viruses. I think what I have found through all of this is we've now ended up connecting with colleagues virtually and teaching classes virtually, kind of by surprise and spontaneously rather than really planning it, is the human spirit, and I've learned this in my work with burn patients, the human spirit is incredibly resilient, and we find ways to connect, to recover, and I think what will happen, I hope what will happen, is when this is all over, we find a way when we can finally really physically connect again with friends and colleagues, that we respect and honor that more than maybe we did in the past. And I look forward to that opportunity.
Dr. Isabella.
Thank you. I think that it's easy for us. Well, first of all, I think that there's a lot of anxiety, of course, and that to me is related to what I was talking about earlier, where we prefer the stable state. We're uncomfortable with upheaval. But one of the tendencies I think we need to try to avoid is to glorify life before a pandemic, to somehow just overlook everything that is not ideal about how we've been living our lives prior to now, so that we're not unrealistic about what we're missing. And then to recognize that this is going to it's a change that will require adaptation, and that takes time. So whatever happens next is not going to happen quickly. And this idea that's in line with what Nalini has been talking about, this difference between the former state and the third state, to just recognize that whatever that third state becomes, whatever the new normal becomes, it's not going to be the same as life prior to the pandemic, but that's okay because, in fact, it might be better. So we shouldn't fear it just because we don't know what it's going to look like. And I to me, at an emotional level, that is a comfort.
Yeah. It's Dr. Russell Isabella, Associate Professor of Family and Consumer Studies at the University of Utah, joined by Dr. Scott Ward, Professor and the Chair of Physical Therapy and Athletic Training at the University of Utah. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. Very much. Pleasure to be here.
Nalini Nadkarni, I wanted to ask you about something that you've been writing about. I know you're putting together a book, so I don't want to jump the gun here, but I do want to ask you about this concept from this economist and philosopher that you write about, Nassim Nicholas Taleb. He writes about anti-fragility. Mm-hmm. Would you just say something about that? I find this fascinating, and it really plays into all of this, that we need to sort of lean into the idea of error and disturbance.
Right. That the book Anti-Fragility is really a remarkable book. I think it's a little bit dense to read, but the essence of it is that systems can respond to disturbances in different ways and sort of evolve ways of dealing with those disturbances. One type of system can be what he calls resilient. That is, you have built into a system, if you're disturbed, you will boing back to it. You will boing back to your former state. And so the system invests in that boingy backness. A second one is that you might have a robust system, one that sort of resists the difficulties of disturbance. And so you can think of a tree that's really strong and firm, and it doesn't move in the wind. It just resists that wind. And so both of those systems involve investing in the materials and sort of characteristics that allow them to be resilient or robust, but they're basically seeing disturbance as being negative. What he says is that there are some systems that are what he calls anti-fragile.
Yeah.
That is, they've actually evolved to welcome resistance, to sort of use disturbance, they welcome disturbance. They use disturbance to make them stronger. And I think our immune systems can be viewed as anti-fragile systems, that when we get attacked, so to speak, by a virus, our body learns how to respond to that, and that gives us strength against the next entry of that virus. But he also says that businesses, for example, can embrace being anti-fragile. Rather than trying to avert economic problems, they can welcome them in order to sort of weed out the problems that make them less than strong. And so he's sort of an advocate for, rather than resisting disturbance, to allow ourselves to welcome it because of the fact that disturbance and recovery can invite us to explore the emerging and converging elements that help us to understand the essence of our business or our institution or our lives and make us more strong, I guess, in a complex way to whatever disturbance might occur in the future.
I loved this insight that came from Ellen Bromberg. She was in your colloquium. She's mm-hmm. a modern dancer, modern dance instructor. And she talked about this idea that art, like the process of art, is one of intentional disruption. And I had never mm-hmm. thought about it that way. So art is a way of us looking at disruption and just, I guess, leaning into disruption as well.
Yeah, she is just an amazing dancer and thinker. She was just one of the most brilliant people in our colloquium, I have to say. And when she was listening to all of us talk about the negative aspects of disturbances, of forest fires and infection and, you know, depression, economic depressions, she listened. And then in her quiet way, she said, you know, to an artist, disruption and disturbance is what we can consider a portal to the new. It's where a disturbance in the past of a past system allows something new to emerge. So for instance, she said, you know, in ballet, which is full of strictures in terms of structure and gender roles and movements, there was a rebellion against that. There was a disturbance in the practice of ballet, and modern dance emerged. And so this expressive world of modern dance, of improv, of avant-garde movement and performances emerged because of the disturbance. Now, she also said, we still have some of the relic structures of ballet in modern dance. We call pliés and jetés. We use some of the vocabulary in many of the movements and the technique. But the concept of dance, of what it's for, of what it can express, was really the result of a disturbance to ballet that allowed modern dance to emerge. And boom, when she said that, all of us just like went, oh my gosh, that's incredible. Because then we began thinking about our disturbances in our fields as potentially a portal to the new, instead of only thinking of it in terms of tragedy, disaster. And that was a really wonderful way to think about it.
I want to draw people's attention to the Salt Lake Tribune on Sunday, where you have an op-ed called A Box Full of Darkness. It's a reference to the Mary Oliver poem. It's going to be on Sunday, so check out that. Nalini Adkarni, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, Doug.
And check out the film Fallen Tree. You can find it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. Our intern is Natu Tway, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.